Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. For younger generations, it's hard to remember that HIV/AIDS in this country was once considered a death sentence. But at least for those with access to the right drugs and medical care, what was once a plague can now be controlled with a prescription.
I really stay on top of my health. I'm now an avid cyclist. As just a regular light ride, I knock out, 20 to 30 miles. For me, it's something I never thought I'd be able to do.
Men and women infected with HIV are living fuller and longer lives.
But you do the best you can, you continue to take your meds, and I believe that and being where I am mentally with this is why I'm still here.
It's true that HIV hits gay men hardest, but less talked about is the damage it's doing to African Americans, gay and straight. I'm Sarah Varney. It's Health Dialogues, and we'll get started right after this. Welcome to Health Dialogues. I'm Sarah Varney, sitting in for Scott Schaefer. HIV/AIDS remains a global and domestic epidemic. There are some 1.1 million Americans infected with the virus that causes AIDS, and another 50,000 people become newly infected each year. Even so, a stable of potent drugs has blunted the deadliness of HIV, at least for people who can get regular treatment. And 30 years after the epidemic began, HIV for many is a manageable chronic disease. So what's it like living with HIV today? For those who've just been diagnosed, and for those approaching old age. During the hour ahead, we're going to hear from people with HIV and those caring for people with HIV and scientists in the laboratory studying the virus. First, let's hear from two gay men who are HIV positive. They both live in the San Francisco Bay Area. Randy Allgaier is in his 50s. He's been infected for 25 years. Jason Villalobos is 31 years old. Here's Randy.
I am doing more than most people, and I've beaten the odds. Thank you to the pharmaceutical industry for that. That has a lot to do with it. It's given me 22 years with my partner that I wouldn't have had. My partner is an amazing man who puts up with this crazy A-type person who does too much and calls me on it. We've just developed this synchronicity that I think is the most important part of what's kept me healthy, plus good medical providers. I have an HIV doctor in San Francisco, Dr. Virginia Cafaro, who is one of the best HIV doctors in the city and has been by my side through this journey. If I live to 65, I will be very, very happy. If I live longer, even better. I certainly didn't expect to be living into my 50s, let alone my 60s. My hope is to continue working as long as I can, and my hopes are just to continue living my life with as much quiet integrity as possible.
I'm very obviously hyper aware of my disease. I have a very good weight. I don't look sick. People tell me they would never know that, I had HIV. But the reason why they would never know is because I pay attention to my health. I take my pills. I take 3 pills every morning when I wake up. I really stay on top of my health. I'm now an avid cyclist. I'll get on my bike and I can, as just a regular light ride, I knock out, 20 to 30 miles on my bike. And that's, I will say that is an amazing leap from, getting winded, walking up my stairs and, throwing up in between cars, walking down the street because I'm so nauseous. And so for me, it's something I never thought I'd be able to do. And for me, every time I get on that bike or go put on my running shoes or, walk out my door, it is an amazing victory. And I want people to know that there's so much hope and that there is life after their diagnosis. And you can still be sexy and confident and a good person and healthy after really terrible, life-shattering news. If you work hard at it and you're determined, there is a great life to be lived.
Two HIV-positive men describing a life that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. Joining me now is the director of HIV prevention and research for the city of San Francisco, Dr. Grant Colfax. In those stories, one of the men says, I take my pills, I stay on top of my health, I ride my bike 20 to 30 miles. He says there is a great life to be lived.
Yes, I think that both the stories really show the commitment, passion, and advocacy that many people living with HIV have and continue to have as we move forward in this epidemic. And I think that in the last 10 years in particular, things have really changed for individuals living with HIV, for people affected by HIV. We have much better treatments now. Many people can expect to have a normal lifespan, even if they become HIV infected. And I also think the stories tell us the paradox of things getting better in many ways, which is a cause for celebration and hope. And at the same time, we continue to have hundreds of new infections, even in San Francisco alone, every year. So I think that the question is, how do we balance this hope, promise, and advocacy with the fact that we still have an infectious disease that is still infecting large numbers of particularly gay men in San Francisco and throughout California?
This is a disease that was once considered a plague, and now in many ways it's a prescription, at least for those who can get access to the right drugs. And so I wonder, how does HIV/AIDS becoming a chronic disease, an illness that needs to be managed, how does that change how public health officials approach it?
I think that's a really good question. I think that we are approaching the disease differently than we did 25 years ago. It is a chronic disease for many people. I think we still need to realize, however, that up to a quarter of Californians who are HIV infected are unaware of their HIV status. So we have tremendous work to do in that area. And we also need to make sure that people who are infected, who know they're infected, get proper care and treatment. But there's still tremendous issues in terms of access to testing, access to care that we still have to figure out. From a prevention standpoint, we need to balance the fact that it's a chronic disease with making people understand that this is still a lifelong disease, living with a chronic disease, that there's still many side effects of having the disease, that we now look at HIV as not only an infectious disease, but also an inflammatory condition that can result in a lot of what we call comorbid conditions, conditions such as increasing the aging process, increasing cardiovascular disease risk, increasing the risk of developing diabetes. All these factors are really attributable to the virus. So we know with medications and early treatment, we can decrease the chances that somebody develops those complications, but HIV is still no picnic.
Talk, if you can, about this idea of proactively prescribing these antiretroviral drugs.
Well, really the data is increasingly convincing that earlier treatment is better. So we think in San Francisco, for instance, we recommend as a public health policy that everybody who is HIV infected be offered treatment, because we think that the earlier you start treatment, the less likely it is that you're going to develop complications due to having the virus out of control in your body. So the way to think about it is, the more virus you have in your body, not only the more likely is it that you will develop HIV-related complications, but we also know now that it's more likely that you will develop premature aging and end organ damage. And by that, I mean problems with your heart and your kidneys. So the data are clear that the earlier you start treatment, the more you suppress the virus, the more likely it is that you will not develop these complications over the long term. The other point is, in starting treatment earlier, we're also hoping that people feel healthier and are less likely to pass on the virus because they have a suppressed viral load.
Explain what you mean by virally suppressed. Some people might not understand
so
what that means.
So when we talk about viral load suppression, it means taking medications to reduce the level of virus to what are undetectable levels in your body. Now, it's important to emphasize the virus was always there. We haven't figured out how to eradicate the virus from the body, but it's suppressed to very low levels, so it's not replicating to the degree of that it would cause end organ damage or illness.
And as you mentioned, there are still a surprising percentage of people who are infected with HIV and don't know it.
Correct.
Increasing awareness of infection is one of President Obama's domestic goals. How do you do that? How do you get people who might not want to know to get tested, to stick around for the results, and then get treatment?
Right. Well, I think it was one of the things that the gentleman was saying earlier, that there are options available and treatment is available. So people should not be afraid of finding out that they have HIV. And we're really working in the health department, both at the local level, the state level, and nationally, to help our colleagues and help our community members locally to end the discrimination stigma that very much still goes with this disease in many communities. So at the health department, we think everybody should be tested for HIV and should become a normal part of healthcare for people to get an HIV test. If they're at risk for HIV, we recommend people get tested every 6 months. So gay men in San Francisco, if people use drugs, transgenders, we advise getting tested every 6 months so people know their HIV status.
And you see oftentimes these rapid testing mobiles going around the Castro.
So,
you also see them sometimes in Los Angeles. How has rapid testing changed the ability of public health officials to really identify people who may unknowingly have HIV?
Yeah, well, I think that it's just a much more efficient system now. So rapid testing, when we talk about rapid testing, it's not only bringing testing more into the community and emphasizing those community efforts, which, you know, really were developed in San Francisco as well as other jurisdictions, but also the test is more rapid now. So it used to be 10 years ago when you went for an HIV test, you'd have to get a blood draw. They would send it off. You'd have to wait 1 or 2 weeks to see whether your test was negative or positive. Now we have rapid HIV testing, which means even with a swab of oral fluid or a finger prick of blood, you can get your HIV test results within 20 minutes. So it's really revolutionized the testing efforts.
San Francisco's Department of Public Health has, of course, been a pioneer in HIV prevention and treatment even before AIDS had a name. And you have this idea of something called community viral loads. Mm-hmm. Explain what that is.
At an individual level, the viral load is really a measure of how many viral particles are in somebody's body. And at the individual level, at the patient level, what the goal is to reduce the viral load to undetectable levels. So we know that if people have an undetectable viral load, they do much better than people who have a detectable viral load, significantly so. And the medications that we've developed, especially over the last 10 years, really do a very good job of suppressing the viral load. So what we've done is taken that paradigm at the individual level and thought about, well, what about the viral load of a community? Because we know HIV circulates in certain communities. So now what we're looking at is, rather than just focusing on the individual level, how do we look at networks and communities of people and look at the viral load there as a measure of how we're doing in terms of our public health approach to HIV prevention and treatment? So if you look at a neighborhood, if you look at a certain group of people to see what the viral load is in that community, it helps us focus our public health efforts, use our resources better, reach out to the community, get community input on what needs to be done to best affect treatment and prevention in our city.
Dr. Grant Colfax is Director of HIV Prevention and Research with the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
The only person that knew that I was HIV positive for a very long time was the medical professionals and my very best friend who lives in Nigeria. I wouldn't talk to anyone in the community. I wouldn't receive any services. I only went to my doctor's appointments and lab appointments after my son was born. I had to go through the protocol to ensure his safety as well. I went to those appointments. Other than that, I didn't talk about it.
My initial diagnosis, I told my dad's mom, and that's when she compared it to the devil's disease. She was like, you know, that's what gay people get when, you know, they're doing something out of God's will. And I mean, both sides of my family are really religious, so they justify anything with everything. That's just how we grew up.
Ooh, my husband. How is my husband dealing with this? He hasn't been dealing with it all that great. We have had some very severe marital ups and downs. We actually split up for quite some time, and we're living in separate households for a while. It's taken a toll on the marriage as well as for him, and to get him to go and get educated is difficult because where he comes from, HIV is a death sentence.
In LA, we travel in packs. So it's like you have your 3 car loads full of friends, and it's like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, or now you can say 1, 2, 3. So one of you guys is positive and you don't know it. And that kind of shuts people down because in all reality, a lot of them aren't getting tested. A lot of them don't know.
In the community in the South Central area where I come from and where I currently live, I can honestly say until today and even back in the day, I never, ever sat down with anyone while I was negative or with anyone who was negative even till today and just sparked up a discussion about HIV.
In the African American community, people really don't get tested because of stigma. Services are accessible, but nobody really talks about it. And for young African Americans, whether we do everything we're supposed to or not, a lot of our foundation is church or it is our family. It's just how we are and how we operate. So 9 out of 10, you don't want to see anyone you know. You don't want to be considered a hoe. Like, the numbers are consistently going up, but it's still a secret in the African American community.
That was Lavira Anam, a mother of two boys in her 30s, and 23-year-old Chris Wilson. Both are Black Angelinos, and both are infected with HIV. Two people who know the African-American HIV story all too well. Greg Millett works in the White House as the senior policy advisor for the Office of National AIDS Policy. He's on the phone from Washington, D.C. And Valerie Wagner is the education director for AIDS Project Los Angeles. She joins us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California. Greg, I'll start with you. We just heard from two HIV-positive African-Americans who live in Los Angeles. One is a mother of two boys, the other a young gay man. But despite their very different lives, they both describe a real sense of isolation and shame.
Absolutely. And what we just heard is something that is echoed quite a bit among people living with HIV in the United States. Prior to pulling together the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, the staff in our office went to various communities in the U.S. to hear how people living with HIV feel that they're being treated or having access to medications, et cetera. And one thing that we heard over and over again is that despite that we're getting into the third decade of the epidemic, that many people said that they had experienced either overt or some sort of slight discrimination that was associated with their HIV status. So, for instance, in the rural South, we heard about a woman who was pregnant and HIV positive, where her doctor told her that she needed to have an abortion without realizing that there are medications that are available that keep women who are HIV positive from delivering babies who are also HIV positive. We also heard in places that were somewhat unexpected, like New York City, people living with HIV who weren't even able to get dental care. So these issues of stigma crop up over and over again. And there are several things that we also know that stigma is associated with not just delaying getting tested for HIV, but it's also associated with not accessing care for people who are HIV positive for fear of others finding out. And it's also associated with not accessing life-saving medications that can prolong people's lives once they're diagnosed with HIV.
And Valerie Wagner, you talk about the stigma of HIV in the Black community very much in your work in Los Angeles. Where does that stigma come from? Why is it so pronounced in the African-American community?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure if we have any one answer as to why that is. You know, by and large, still here we are in almost the third decade of this disease. And in Black and brown communities, there's still this prevalence of denial that exists. People are still convinced that this is just a white gay disease, so that if they're not white or gay, that they don't have to worry about, you know, being infected with HIV or becoming infected with HIV. There's homophobia that still exists in Black communities, Black and Latino communities, so that being lesbian or gay is still seen as a white disease as well, sort of influence of the man. And we don't talk about sex. I think Greg pointed out stories, you know, in the rural South that are prevalent here in Los Angeles as well. People don't want to get tested because they don't want to know. There's a lot of shame that's associated with even going out and getting an HIV test and knowing your status. People don't want to lose their families, you know, so to come out to your family as being HIV positive means that then you have to also explain other things about your life that maybe you're not comfortable in sharing with your family. There's influence of the church here in Los Angeles, the Black church. You know, not all of us go to church, but there's this, we've been taught from a very young age about the importance of church and the importance of God. And when you have preachers that are preaching messages of damnation to lesbian and gay people or damnation about homosexuality, then people aren't comfortable in coming out and being their whole selves.
One of the statistics that I found the most shocking was the high rate of infection among African Americans. And I'll just read you this from the Centers for Disease Control. There are about 1.1 million Americans infected with HIV, and almost half are Black. I thought that was so surprising that African Americans are just about 12% of the U.S. population, but they're 46% of HIV infections. Greg Millett, why is that? What accounts for that disparity?
Well, there are various reasons that account for the disparity, and some of them are reasons that we've been touching on a little bit in this program, but there's some others that we haven't mentioned. So, for instance, some of the reasons why we see the disparities among African Americans is because sexually transmitted diseases overall, we find a higher prevalence in black communities compared to other communities in the United States. And we know that if someone has an STD and if they're HIV negative, they're more likely to acquire HIV during any act of unprotected sex. And if someone is HIV positive and has an STD, they're more likely to transmit their infection to someone else during an act of unprotected sex. So having higher STIs is an issue in the black community. We also know that there are fairly high rates of undiagnosed HIV infection. There are quite a few people in the black community who don't know whether or not we're infected with HIV. And we also know from studies that people with undiagnosed HIV infection are responsible for most of the transmissions that take place each year in the United States. So that also fuels further the disparities that we see in the black community. There are other issues such as poverty, access to care, people who are not accessing care, and if they're HIV positive, they're not availing themselves or able to avail themselves of drugs that not only reduce transmissibility, but also prolong their life. And that's certainly an issue that makes the disparities even worse within the black community. There are many other issues that are out there, but it's not just one bullet or one issue that needs to be solved. There's many different facets to this that have to be addressed for us to really get a grip on what's taking place with HIV infection among African Americans.
And there had been this thought that perhaps one of the reasons for this disparity was the high numbers of black men, especially young black men, going into prison, but that was debunked, was it not?
Well, yes and no. What we do know from the prison studies, or several studies that have been done, not only that CDC has done, but that the Bureau of Prisons has done, is that people who are living with HIV who are in prison, the overwhelming majority of those individuals contracted HIV before entering prison. And when we take a look at the HIV transmission rate within prison, we do know that those cases do occur, that there are people who seroconvert and contract HIV while they're in prison. But those numbers are very low. They're, in fact, much lower than the numbers that we see among people who are outside of prison. So that's not necessarily the issue that's taking place. The larger issue that's taking place with African Americans and imprisonment is that when you have a system that basically takes away a large number of African American men from a geographical area, that really disrupts the sex ratio and the balance that you have there, such that beforehand you might have had a one-on-one balance from every man to every woman in that geographic area. But with many men who are incarcerated, what you have is a balance where you might have one man to three or four women. And we do know that patterns of concurrency, patterns of having multiple partners, certainly affects the HIV rates that we see in various communities, including the African-American community.
And Valerie Wagner, the black community, especially in a place like Los Angeles, is vast and it's quite diverse. You have upper and middle class families, and then you have areas where there's persistent poverty and crime and lack of access to health care. So how do you try and change these attitudes about HIV infection across such a diverse group?
Well, one of the things that we do, we go into different communities. We actually try to meet people where they are. In dealing with young gay men, we try to make sure that we design programs that they are influential in helping us to design, right, so that they can tell us how best to reach them and their peers. When we go into affluent communities, we try to make sure that we engage popular opinion leaders in those communities to help us shape and form prevention messages that will speak to their peer groups. One of the things that that Greg mentioned about HIV and black communities, and one of the things that we know as well, we test later than most communities. So people are actually, when they're going to get tested, they're testing for HIV, and then within 6 months to a year, they're also getting an AIDS diagnosis. So we're testing later. Prevention messages have traditionally not been tailored to our communities, and so now we, APLA and other organizations in Los Angeles, are trying to develop prevention messages that tailor to specific ethnic communities.
What are some specific examples of that?
We've done some things in South Los Angeles. We did a social marketing campaign where we actually put up billboards along sort of major corridors in Los Angeles, the Crenshaw Corridor, that simply said, flip the script. And that speaks to that 1 in 3 black gay men are HIV positive. And what we wanted to do was to put up those billboards that showed faces of black gay men engaging in conversations. And then we went out into the streets and talked to people as they were looking at the billboards. Part of this was just to create a conversation in black communities about the impact of HIV. I think people get overwhelmed when they see statistics and numbers and percentages, and we tried to put it in as simple terms as possible so that people would get the impact of this disease in our communities.
Valerie Wagner from AIDS Project Los Angeles and Greg Millett, a White House senior policy advisor for the Office of National AIDS Policy. We'll continue this interview after a short break. To hear more from people living with HIV, go to our website, healthdialogues.org. I'm Sarah Varney. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
On the October edition of Health Dialogues, we'll examine the health issues of Native Americans in California. What effect have gambling revenues had on the health of a population known to have high rates of diabetes and tobacco use? Native American health issues, next month on Health Dialogues.
Welcome back to Health Dialogues. I'm Sarah Varney. We're talking about the face of HIV/AIDS in California today. Let's get back to my interview with Valerie Wagner and Greg Millett, two experts on HIV in the black community. Greg, earlier this summer, President Obama unveiled this new domestic strategy against HIV/AIDS, and it included a pledge to slow infections, to increase access to care for those who are infected, and this promise to really close this gap that we've been talking about, this gap between racial and ethnic groups. And yet, this new strategy doesn't come with any additional money, and I'm wondering how the White House can make good on those pledges.
In terms of the National HIV/AIDS strategy, in terms of implementing the strategy, we announced about $30 million for fiscal year 2010 that are associated with HIV prevention efforts that are associated with the strategy, with additional monies that we are hoping are going to be invested within the strategy next year. One thing when you take a look at HIV prevention as well as care efforts in the United States is that you see that we actually spend quite a bit of funds dealing with HIV in the U.S. In the U.S., we spend about $19 billion each year for HIV prevention as well as care efforts, which is quite a bit of money. One of the things that we need to ask ourselves is whether or not we are directing those monies to doing the right activities in the U.S. And if we are directing them to the right activities, are those activities actually things that are scalable, that are able to address the HIV issues in the United States? Another question that we have to ask ourselves as well with those monies is whether or not we're directing those efforts to the appropriate groups who are affected with HIV in the United States. One of the things that you see often is people don't necessarily understand epidemiologically where the epidemic is concentrated in the U.S. And we were very clear when we were pulling together the strategy to make sure that we highlighted which groups where the HIV domestic epidemic is concentrated, because HIV doesn't affect everybody generally. There are specific groups such as African Americans, gay and bisexual men, Latinos, and substance users that have a higher concentration of HIV compared to other Americans.
Valerie, do you think that this new focus on specifically the black community will have some impact a few years down the road?
I certainly hope it does. It's easy for people to talk about AIDS in Africa, and people don't realize that AIDS in black communities in America actually in some cases is worse than AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, so particularly with black gay men. But I think the biggest thing for me that I want people to understand and to remember that we need to go back to sort of some basics, right? HIV is a sexually transmitted disease. And so if you're sexually active, you're at risk for exposure to HIV. I think if we broaden and sort of normalize this disease, that people will become more educated about it and come to realize that this is not about whether you're gay or straight. It's not about whether you're a man or a woman. It's about whether you're having sex. And if you're engaging in sex, then you need to be tested and you need to know your status. It's better to know than to not know. I think there's a tendency, or there has been a tendency in black communities to just you know, if we don't think about it, we don't talk about it, if I don't know my status, I don't have to worry about it. And that's what's continuing to drive this disease in Black communities.
And if accomplishing that last goal of the National AIDS Strategy, this reducing this disparity, means that you have to take on these much larger cultural questions about the church, for instance, demonizing homosexuality, how do you even start to do that?
Well, some of the efforts that we've done, we've actually gone into some churches in South Los Angeles. We've met with what we like to call the church mothers, the grandmothers that have influence in the church, if not with the pastor directly, but with their own little circles of influence within the church. And so we've talked to some of the church elders and educated them about the impacts of HIV/AIDS, the modes of transmission, things that you can do to keep yourself safe. We've given them information about where to get tested, what an HIV-positive test means, given them information about access to resources within the county. And they have actually become some of our greatest foot soldiers, if you will, within these churches to help spread the messages. It's difficult for us as lay people to go and talk directly with ministers. Ministers tend to talk better with other ministers. And so we actually have ministers that, if they're not gay, they're gay-friendly. They actually understand and get, you know, the impacts of this disease in Black communities. They've been able to also sort of move some of these ministers, if not to actually engage in talking about sex from the pulpit, but at least to stop demonizing gay men in particular that are sitting in their pews and supporting their churches. So I think it's crucial that we figure out more creative ways and continue to figure out creative ways to engage the church in this and fighting this disease in Black communities. Also, our healthcare providers. We do some work with healthcare providers where we actually provide them with education. A lot of times people aren't comfortable going to a doctor and disclosing, you know, about their activity because they fear rejection from their doctor. So we've actually sort of worked with providers to help them understand how to engage and how to ask the right questions. Because if you don't ask the right questions, people can easily sort of self-select out of any conversations about their sexual behavior. We know that there are men in the community that are having sex with both men and women and not talking about it. They don't identify as gay or bisexual. There are women in the community that are having sex with men and women and not talking about it, and they don't identify as lesbian or bisexual either. It's easier to sort of cast this heterosexual label, and for people that see this as a gay disease, to identify as heterosexual means that you're okay, but we know that that's also not the case. Black women are being infected at alarming rates, and we know that these are women that are engaged in heterosexual behavior, and I think Greg pointed out one of the reasons why we see this happening, you know, with the large number of Black men that are incarcerated, you have fewer Black men for more Black women. And so you have women that are engaging in sex with one man who may be engaging in sex with multiple partners, or you may have a rare case where a woman is engaging in sex with multiple men. So we've got to start talking about behavior and get away from labels if we're going to start stemming the tide of this disease in Black communities.
I'd like to mention as well is that we also can't talk about behavior alone. That's been part of the reason why our efforts towards addressing HIV in Black communities have been stymied. We know from many studies that the reasons that Black gay men and Black women are at greater risk for HIV infection is not necessarily because of their behavior. There have been several studies that have compared Black gay men with white gay men and Black women with white women, and they found that these individuals in Black communities engaged in comparable, if not less, risk behavior, but we were still more likely to be infected with HIV.
I want to thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure, Sarah. Thank you very much.
Valerie Wagner from AIDS Project Los Angeles and Greg Millett, a White House senior policy advisor for the Office of National AIDS Policy. There's been billions of dollars spent trying to understand exactly how the HIV virus behaves, why it's so formidable, and how researchers can best control or eliminate it. One of the most preeminent HIV research labs in the U.S. is the Gladstone Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. I paid a visit to the institute's director, Warner Green. I asked him how well we understand the virus's makeup and behavior once it's been transmitted.
We have an extensive understanding of this virus, how it works, how it replicates, how it moves from cell to cell. And this detailed knowledge has led now to the production of 26 different antiviral drugs, which have transformed the face of HIV/AIDS from an acute death sentence to literally a chronic manageable disease.
Can you just describe, though, for us how the virus actually attacks the immune system?
Yes. So HIV binds to the surface of a type of cell called the CD4T lymphocyte. This lymphocyte could be likened to the conductor of the immunological orchestra. And so it takes out the absolute key cell that is involved in controlling, regulating, coordinating the immune system, leading to the profound deficiency that we know as AIDS.
And I understand that the virus is quite dynamic. It's always changing inside the body as our immune system works to suppress it. And as the virus replicates, it doesn't necessarily make perfect copies. So there are errors as it's replicating. And I wonder how scientists study something that's just constantly evolving.
Well, it's actually the error-prone nature of HIV's reverse transcriptase, plus the fact that the virus can recombine with other viruses that happen to be within the same cell, lead to this, not to a single species of HIV, but to a quasi-species, a swarm of different viruses. So yes, we're constantly tracking this swarm of viruses. Also, that's what allows this virus to become so resistant so quickly to antiviral drugs if they're used as single agents rather than as combination therapy.
And do we understand fully what the virus does once it's inside the body, how it moves, where it moves?
Yes. Well, we're increasingly understanding the life cycle is quite well understood now. We know that the virus contains RNA. The RNA is converted into DNA by the reverse transcriptase. The virus then integrates into our own host DNA, our chromosomes, and then it begins to make new copies of itself. Now, where in terms of the different organ systems, so certainly the virus resides in the lymphoid system. It resides in the gastrointestinal tract. There's evidence that it can infect the brain. So the virus can find its way into multiple tissues, multiple organs, and this may make treatment of all of those different sites more challenging.
And I'm curious, is all HIV equal? I mean, is HIV equally infectious in Cape Town as it is in Jakarta or Delhi or Los Angeles?
Well, we know that there are different clades or subtypes of the virus. And, for example, in Cape Town, the predominant clade is clade C. Here in the United States, in Los Angeles, it's clade B. The biology of the virus may differ slightly from clade to clade, but in general, they share more similarities than differences.
And what might some of those differences be?
Some have proposed that the clade C viruses may spread more rapidly or more effectively from person to person than the clade B viruses by normal sexual transmission. That is not, in my mind, a proven fact yet.
And to what extent are scientists looking into how or if this virus behaves differently, whether or not it's in a woman versus a man?
Oh, well, certainly the women are being targeted by this virus. There's no question. 7 out of 10 new infections occurring in Africa involve women. The nature of the transmission, how the virus gains entry into the female reproductive tract, across the female reproductive tract, is an area of tremendous focus. And it's been so gratifying to see, for example, the successful introduction of a microbicide that can prevent or certainly retard, not completely prevent, but certainly retard the transmission of HIV from a man to a woman. That's a high point in the history of HIV therapeutics and prevention.
And we used to hear talk of a cure or a vaccine for HIV. Then that seemed to have sort of faded away, that talk kind of faded away. And now it seems to have come back. Why is that?
Well, I think we're hopeful. Hopeful on the vaccine front in that there has been a glimmer of success in the Thai vaccine trial. There may have been the production of some type of immunity very early in that trial that led to a degree of protection.
Explain to folks what the Thai vaccine trial was.
Okay, so the Thai vaccine trial combined two vaccines that neither of which had worked very effectively, had not worked at all. But when they were combined together, much the way we do combination antiretroviral therapy, suddenly now this combination led to a statistically significant protection, barely reached the level of statistical significance. However, if you look more closely at the trial, there appeared to be protection early on that waned later. So if that's true and we can reproduce that early protection, I think we move beyond from the point of view, is an HIV vaccine possible, to yes, a vaccine is possible. How do we, it becomes more of a technical challenge rather than a theoretical problem. Eradication, cure of HIV infection. Certainly the challenge of HIV latency, these reservoirs of virus, slumbering virus that cannot be attacked by antiretroviral drugs, they have, they're the reason that no one is cured with the current antiretroviral therapies. I think there is reason for optimism that we might be able to achieve a functional cure. And by that I mean we might be able to treat people with combinations of agents that would allow them to discontinue their antiretroviral therapy, and yet their viral load would remain very low. This is very exciting work, clearly at the cutting edge of the field right now. Whether we'll be able to achieve true eradication, where we wipe out every last virus in an infected individual's body, I think that's a higher bar to clear. But I also have not completely given up on that notion either.
What do you see as some of the other more promising areas of research? You mentioned microbicides. You touched on vaccine. Is there anything else?
Well, the latency area, the vaccines, the any type of new prevention, for example, pre-exposure prophylaxis, using the current antiretrovirals, can we give people who are at high risk for acquiring HIV a pill a day and prevent them from acquiring the virus? We should know the answer to that question soon. Within the next few months, the first PrEP trials will be completing, and so we look forward to whether or not that approach as a biomedical intervention to prevent HIV transmission will work or not.
Where's that work being done?
Some of that work is being done. One of the largest trials is being done here at Gladstone, led by Dr. Robert Grant, 11 international trial sites. But there are many PrEP trials that are underway, and we'll be hearing the results of these trials within the next few months.
And as you're sitting here describing this, it's as if you can just see the virus in your head. Do you,
absolutely.
When you go to bed at night, do you have this virus sort of spinning around in your
head? I try not to dream about the virus at night.
Warner Green is director of the Gladstone Institute of Virology and Immunology at UC San Francisco. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that in the next 5 years, half of all Americans living with HIV will be over 50. That's about 600,000 people. The complex interaction between aging, HIV, and antiretroviral therapy isn't well understood. But as Kenny Goldberg reports from KPBS in San Diego, there's evidence the disease can exacerbate even the more common ailments of old age.
San Diegan William Robinson, not his real name, is tall and painfully thin. He's 64 years old. Robinson has been living with HIV since 1985. Back then, HIV was a virtual death sentence. But in 1987, the first drug to treat the disease was introduced. It was called AZT.
And at that time, they gave high doses, and people did not really do well with AZT. But I was one of the fortunate ones who have gone through that door and out the other side.
Since those early days, Robinson has taken a variety of different medications. He says his HIV has been well controlled, and he's tried to keep a positive attitude. Then all of a sudden, not too long ago, Robinson began coughing up blood.
I worked in the medical field, so I knew right away it was an alarming thing to cough up blood. So I immediately was treated for that in the emergency room and then for much follow-up after that.
Robinson was eventually diagnosed with something called non-cirrhotic portal hypertension. The condition affects the portal vein in the liver. If left untreated, the disease can cause excessive bleeding. Dr. Edward Kachai is Robinson's physician. He's a specialist in HIV at UC San Diego Medical Center. Kachai says only a small percentage of people living with HIV have non-cirrhotic portal hypertension.
However, the prevalence among those individuals just specifically exposed to the older generation medications, it's much higher. It goes in the range to 4 or 5%.
Kachai says this condition appears to be a previously unknown side effect of AZT. He says people who've been living with HIV for years face other health consequences.
People with HIV develop an increased likelihood of cardiovascular conditions, metabolic complications, diabetes, osteoporosis, and certain types of non-AIDS-related cancers.
Researchers say, in essence, the inflammatory nature of HIV prematurely ages the body. That puts people at higher risk for a variety of health conditions. William Robinson says besides his recently discovered liver ailment, he hasn't felt as mentally sharp as he used to.
Sometimes short-term memory, I have a difficulty with that. I can remember things long ago, but yet something that might have occurred yesterday, or I would have a hard time remembering.
Dr. Igor Grant directs the HIV Neurobehavioral Research Center at UCSD. He says mild cognitive problems affect about half of those living with HIV.
There is some evidence now that among people who are surviving into their 60s and 70s with HIV, there might be what you might term an acceleration of aging or an amplification of that process in some people, so that you see somewhat more cognitive impairment than you would have expected.
Grant says the blood flow in the brains of HIV-infected people is normally seen in uninfected people who are 15 years older. He says it's unclear whether antiretroviral drugs contribute to the problem. Grant says either way, medications don't wipe out HIV.
Virus is never truly eliminated from the body. We can suppress it. Maybe you can't even see it in the plasma anymore, but it's sitting somewhere in tissue, in reservoirs, one of which may be the brain. And even maybe at very low level, it keeps causing this chronic inflammatory stress that may produce a cumulative kind of brain injury.
William Robinson says it's been challenging trying to keep his health together. In addition to living with HIV, he's had tuberculosis and two bouts of pneumonia.
But you do the best you can. You continue to take your meds. And I believe that and being where I am mentally with this is why I'm still here.
Researchers say it's important to keep in mind that the AIDS epidemic began less than 30 years ago. How HIV affects aging is an emerging field. Scientists are just beginning to understand the long-term effects of the disease and the therapies designed to control it. For Health Dialogues, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
Bob Anderson is a nurse with the Marin AIDS Project, and he's here with me now. He provides care to HIV-positive patients in their homes in Marin County. Many of his patients are older, like the man we just heard. They're dealing with the all-too-common diseases of old age, but also facing problems that are a result of taking intensive drugs to suppress the HIV virus. Bob Anderson, welcome to Health Dialogues.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me here.
As a nurse who goes into people's homes to provide medical care in many ways just to support them, how is caring for an older person with HIV different than someone who's not?
The difference is that there's a whole complex layer that's beneath their aging process. So it's sort of a merging of HIV, having taken drugs for many years, and looking at the layer of their systems versus looking at their aging process. It just happens naturally.
So how do you pull those two things apart?
It's interesting. It's a challenge. A lot of what I'm doing when I go in initially into the home is listening. I'm listening. I'm looking. You know, I'm looking around the house to see, you know, is there food on the table? Is there the environment clean? I mean, I'm looking at their body, I'm looking at their environment, what's going on. I'm listening to what they have to tell me, because a lot of these folks are so isolated to begin with. But I do a head-to-toe assessment. I'm, you know, looking at their medications. I'm looking to be sure they're taking their medications, because a lot of it now that I'm seeing is actually being able to help people remember to do things.
Is that because of the short-term memory loss that we heard about in the man in the
yeah.
piece? Is that pretty common?
Yeah, most definitely, the short-term. And also just because there's so many things. I mean, being elderly and having HIV, I mean, their life involves many, many medical appointments, much more than the average person.
And to that point, when we talk about older people with HIV, many of them are still actually quite young, even in their 50s and early 60s.
Yeah, this is true, but they've been taking medications, some of them, since they were in their 20s. So there's been a breakdown in their systems, their livers, their kidneys. And on top of that, their whole environment has been different. A lot of them have lost their friends. You know, it was almost like a war when the AIDS epidemic came, and a lot of their support systems were wiped out.
I know you can't tell us the specifics of patients, but perhaps just paint a picture for us of one of the patients that you're thinking of. When you walk into their home, what do you see? Do they look vital and healthy, or are they oftentimes sitting on the couch and watching television? What do you see when you go in?
I'll tell you, I don't see vital and healthy. If anything, it's quite the opposite of that. I mean, a couple scenarios. One person who never answers her telephone, who's completely isolated, and I pretty much just depend upon just showing up there and know that he is going to be there. And I ring the doorbell. I see him sitting in his dark home through the window with a huge screen TV and lying on his couch. And it usually takes him about 10 minutes to get to the door. And this man is 55 years old and a hoarder, has no friends. Another person I see is 70, and his partner, who is 80, is his main caregiver, who they maintain separate homes that they have to because of, Medicare, and just so that he will have some money to get by on. But he has early stage Alzheimer's, and, you know, it's very questionable whether it's from HIV meds, whether it's the inflammation process of HIV. But I don't see much vital and healthy. And, you know, a really different situation is if they were aging in their 70s, you know, sometimes people can go to adult daycare centers, but or they can go to a cardiac rehab, or they can get into exercise programs. But that is sort of like asking, you know, your 90-year-old grandmother to start using the internet to communicate with you. It's just sort of out of their realm of possibility.
Why is that?
Cognitive, for one, isolation, disease process, they just don't have the energy.
It strikes me for this generation of men in particular who really were sort of the first to get through the epidemic. I mean, these are men who really survived when, as you said, many of their friends and partners did not. How do you see getting older with HIV changing as, you know, this generation passes away and another generation comes up that has taken different antiretroviral drugs, or perhaps their families are still intact? Many of them maybe have adopted children or had biological children. So as this generation, as HIV positive patients get older and their families get older with them, how do you see that experience changing?
I think that'd be a very much different situation. I mean, I have a friend who is married and has two children in her 40s or 30s right now, extended large family. For her, it's going to be much different, of course, than the people who have had their whole background of history wiped out.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bob Anderson is a nurse with the Marin AIDS Project. That's the end of this month's edition of Health Dialogues. Tell us your story by leaving a comment online at healthdialogues.org. You can also listen to past programs and subscribe to our podcast. And we have a blog about the health of communities around California written by the people who live in them, from Calexico to the Port of Long Beach to Oakland. It's called Our State of Health, and you can find it at healthdialogues.org. Next month on Health Dialogues, we examine whether Indian gaming revenues are improving the health of Native Americans in California. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. The director is Susie Racho. Our technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The Health Dialogues team includes online editor Gabriel Cohn, web producer Nick Vidinsky, and outreach coordinator Shuka Kalantari. The senior producer is Polly Stryker. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Sitting in for Scott Schaefer, I'm Sarah Varney. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment. Your health depends on where you live. You can find out why on healthycal.org. and the members of KQED Public Radio.